Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this June 30th, Wednesday. We're going to talk about Thomas Edison this hour. Don't you love being able to do this wide variety of topics? Thomas Edison this hour. And we'll have two guests with us, Jill Jones joining us momentarily, a journalist and author, and later we'll be speaking with Thomas Edison's great-grandson, David Sloan, professor of English at the University of New Haven. Time Magazine's 9th annual special, the history issue, is on Thomas Edison, how one powerful idea changed America. Inside his idea factory, why he's relevant today, Edison, the article says, helped create the American way of innovation. And we need to probably look at him more closely because he's an inspiration, or should be an inspiration for us today. Rather, what we have is the country in danger of losing its preeminence in science and technology. So we have two guests with us. Jill Jones has a really interesting background. She says she had the good fortune and privilege of growing up in Vienna, Libya, London, Paris, Turkey, India, Vietnam, and Indonesia. Her father was an economist for the U.S. Agency for International Development. She's done a great deal of writing, and most applicable to our discussion here, she, after two long, complicated books about the underside of American life, she wanted to write about American success and was drawn to the Gilded Age, those years after the Civil War, when the U.S. emerged as a wealthy industrial power, an amazing engine of invention and prosperity. And while she was reading an old biography of George Westinghouse, she came across his battle with Edison over the domination of the neophyte technology of electricity, known as the War of the Electric Currents. The AC versus DC episode had never been told, she said, in all its gothic and glorious detail. She has a piece in Time that looks at many of the Edison inventions. And later, his great-grandson will be joining us. Hello, Jill. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, always a pleasure to talk about Thomas Edison.
Yeah, I would imagine it's a pleasure to talk about him. I can't believe that anybody, we don't live for all that long a period of time, could invent as many things as this guy invented.
Well, and he still holds the record for number of patents. I think it's 1,092.
Wow.
Yeah.
So should he be an inspiration as this country is, you know, not doing well in terms of churning out scientists and getting people interested in this? What's different about our age when you look at his age, or what, is he just an exceptional genius that allowed somebody like him to flourish and invent all that he did, whereas now we're lucky if we can get somebody to go into science in college?
Well, I don't think there's any lack of inventors. I mean, one of the things that was striking to me when I was working on my book was how glamorous it was to be, well, they refer to themselves as electricians, people who work in the field of invention and electricity and sort of the research on electricity. But, Edison was a rock star in his day. And I thought about that quite a bit. You know, why was he a rock star? I mean, who do we know? We don't know the names of inventors today. And in a way, what happened was that the very system that Edison created that, you know, made it possible to be an inventor, which was to, you know, he referred to it as his invention factory. So he had been, a lone inventor. Well, actually, what he had been was a telegrapher, meaning someone who, you know, with a crack operator of the telegraph. And from that, he came up with some really significant improvements in making the telegraph work. And Western Union was a big, huge company in those days, and they were willing to pay very good money for this. Thomas Edison took that money, and he opened a lab in Menlo Park, New Jersey, which was on the Pennsylvania Railroad line, but otherwise really in the middle of nowhere. And he moved there from Newark with a whole bunch of people who all really had strengths in very different ways. And that was Edison and what he called his boys. And his goal was very commercial. You know, I will invent something on a regular basis that, we can sell and you know, get out there in the markets. And that was part of, I mean, that was really Edison's sort of the big shift, is that he came in and he had lawyers who then connected him with Wall Street and Wall Street money. And so, you know, today there's, I mean, if you look at someplace like IBM, I mean, it takes out huge numbers of patents. I mean, and that's just, you know, one company. I'm sure if you looked at Apple, all these different IT companies, they're taking out huge numbers of patents. But none of those people are individually famous.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, I mean, Edison really sort of created this way of allowing very smart, innovative people who were interested in, you know, kind of emerging technologies to do their work. But in the course of it, you know, people became far more part of, you know, a bigger institution.
Right. So as the article says, and maybe you wrote this, the most lasting contribution might be in the system of industrial invention that he helped pioneer and then bringing together these brains and then market the results.
Right. I didn't write that. That was not in my article. But
could have.
Right.
Okay.
and actually, the person who should really be credited with kind of understanding that is a man named Paul Israel, who has written a couple of really kind of pivotal books about Edison and actually oversees the Edison Archive. So for anyone who's interested in Thomas Edison in this miraculous age we live in vis-a-vis the Internet, I mean, I don't know exactly if it would be a million pieces of, you know, documents, a million documents, but I mean, there is a vast Edison archive online, and that is managed by Paul Israel and a number of other people. But if you're interested in Edison and have particular aspects of his work that you'd like to look into, you know, no problem.
If you can, there's a lot
navigating
of it.
It, because it's like, you know, he had such a big, complicated life, is a little bit tricky, but they're very helpful.
Right. You did write the piece, Let There Be Light, and you've written a book. And I want you to, I just find this so intriguing that you write about the war of the electric currents, the famous AC versus DC episode, which had never been told in all its gothic and glorious detail. What's the glorious detail about AC versus DC?
Well, so in this Westinghouse biography I was reading, I came across several chapters. And in these chapters, I discovered that the first use of the electric chair was part of the feud. Part of the war of the electric currents. So this is really the dark side of Thomas Edison. I mean, all in all, Thomas Edison is this, you know, very endearing, very folksy, very admirable guy. You would not have wanted to be married to him because, you know, not a very present husband.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a, you know, definitely a workaholic. But there was a dark side to him, and it was this episode where, so what happens is Edison invents the incandescent light bulb, which is a huge breakthrough. He also invents everything you need to make the light bulb work, and it's a system of direct current. And he gets his company up and running, and he's, you know, he's launched. I mean, he's got all these customers in downtown New York. The hitch with direct current is it can't economically go more than about a half, and under the best of circumstances, a mile. So Edison's vision of electrifying the world was that you would have generating stations about every mile, burning coal and generating electricity. So you can imagine in the United States, you know, at the turn of the last century, where the country is growing like crazy, there's real limitations on this. And Westinghouse, who was himself, I mean, Edison was definitely a genius, but Westinghouse was a genius also, and he really came into the world of electricity through the railroads. So he gets these patents for something called alternating current, and alternating current is a technology that allows you to send electricity long distances. It means you can have a generating plant anywhere, and that electricity can travel great distances. And it's all based on transformers, which Westinghouse bought patents for and then perfected and improved. So when Westinghouse, you know, comes, you know, announces that he's starting the Westinghouse Electric Company and they're going to use the Stacey technology, Edison is very unhappy. And as they begin to take market share for all the obvious reasons that, you know, you go into a town and say, we will build one generating plant, and as you need to expand the system, we just lay more wires, versus what Edison is saying, we will build one generating plant, then a second. You can see that there's like no contest here. So the way Edison decided to address this as things got, you know, sort of worse and worse, was to try and portray alternating current as the executioner's current. And so Edison was against capital punishment, but nonetheless, he helped this very strange man who was completely committed to the idea of developing an electric chair for the state of New York to replace the hangman's noose.
Oh, my goodness.
And Edison helped the guy with his research. He got him Westinghouse generators, and they made sure that the first, you know, he was an axe murderer, who was electrocuted, for capital punishment in the state of New York, was electrocuted with Westinghouse machines. And there are these incredible memos, again, you can see them online if you want, among the Edison executives saying that just as the word guillotine became a verb in France, the guillotine was invented by a man named Guillotine, so would the verb Westinghoused be applied to people who died of, you know, electrocution or in coming into contact with too much electricity.
Ugh, that is quite a story.
Yes.
Quite a story. It must have been quite something. You think about living without light, but what a thing to light up the world. I mean, that's a big thing to do, isn't it? Imagine what it was like to not have lights.
People did have lights. They just were nowhere as good as electric light. I mean,
right.
At that time, many people had gas light. But remember, you know, every gas light had to be lighted. I mean, it had a flame.
Right.
And Edison always used to talk about how unhealthy gas light was. And there was something to it because it was a flame and it was using the oxygen in the room. The other thing is if the flame went out and the gas kept going, I mean, we still have this problem to this day. If you have a gas stove,
dangerous.
People would be in hotels, the gas light would blow out, they would be asleep, and they would never wake up.
Oh, my goodness.
And then, of course, there was kerosene lamps, there were candlelight, but none of it was anywhere as good as an electric light.
Right. We're going to welcome phone calls for Jill. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. Jill has written one of the pieces in the current issue of Time magazine. It's the 9th annual special history issue. And Thomas Edison, who is featured on the cover holding an incandescent bulb, it looks at the state of invention today and the interest in science and the incredible number of inventions that he had. And she's written, wasn't that a fascinating story about the electric chair? She has done a lot of writing. She's written quite a few nonfiction books, and one of them is on the war of the electric currents. Wow, we have a lot of calls coming in. I love you. You're such a good audience. 800-486-8655, or the email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Jill. Let's start with Jim from Madison. Hi, Jim.
Oh, my name's Jim. We had a little interference there. Do you hear me okay?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, I'm listening to your program as I'm sitting here in my electronics lab and realizing that there's a misconception of Mr. Westinghouse and Mr. Edison in DC and AC current. AC current, everything using alternating current was actually invented by Tesla.
Oh, no, he's in my book.
Transformer.
Don't worry, there's no misunderstanding there. But
okay.
Tesla, but actually Westinghouse had developed an alternating current system. He bought it that from a different set of people.
Well,
Tesla comes on the scene a bit later. Westinghouse actually already has his electric company. He then buys all of Tesla's patents, hires Tesla, and then helps Tesla develop everything, all of which gets perfected for the World's Fair of 1893 and then at the Niagara Falls, power station. So that it's just that the original, the war of the electric currents starts without Tesla. And I should say that Tesla actually was an employee of Edison's, both in Paris and then in New York, because he wanted to persuade Edison that AC was the way to go.
Mm.
He wasn't able to persuade him.
All right, now we go to you, Jim. We need to speak one at a time or we can't hear. Go ahead.
Okay, I didn't realize we were duplexing over each
yes.
other.
Yes.
My comment was that, and I disagree with your summation that alternating current presupposed Tesla. Tesla did, in fact, invent the AC motor, auto transformers, et cetera. Yes, he was employed by Edison. He was employed in New York as a ditch digger to hook up his copper bus bars. And then when his employment ended, Edison even refused to pay him for his services. And all this is documented in a book by and a television special on Nova. And so I disagree with your conclusion that Westinghouse came up with the idea of alternating current. He stole that idea from Mr. Tesla.
Excuse me, he didn't steal it. He bought Tesla's patents. Tesla worked for him. And Tesla himself, late in life, described Westinghouse as, you know, a noble man who no one else could have brought my products to, to the world. And the one thing I will say about Westinghouse that is, you know, sort of a mystery and, distressing is that at a certain point when his company was in trouble, he asked Tesla to forego some of his patent royalties, and Tesla agreed to do it in order to save the Westinghouse company. And that agreement never got changed, so that later in life, Tesla was another eccentric genius, and each of these are sort of the three people who feature in my book, Empires of Light. And Tesla never managed to bring another one of his inventions, and they were amazing inventions, to commercial use. Westinghouse did that. I mean, Tesla, for instance, invented the remote control. In 1898, he was using remote control to send boats around a large pond.
Oh, my.
But, right, no one knew what to do with it. You know, they thought it was magic. He also invented, like, a sort of very early version of the fluorescent light bulb. But, again, you know, and that was, again, part of what Edison was very good at, and actually that Westinghouse was even better at, was taking inventions and turning them into something commercial that you could use. I mean, one of the things that's wonderful about Thomas Edison is he totally misunderstood, and the Time articles really address that. He really misunderstood what the markets were for his own inventions. For instance, the phonograph. He thought the phonograph was essentially a dictaphone machine because he wasn't a person who ever really, you know, kind of enjoyed life and took the pleasures in life that non-workaholics take. So to him, the purpose of the phonograph was, you know, to dictate business kinds of things. Whereas for the rest of the world, it was to listen to music.
Right. Thanks, Jim, for your call. Let's go to Mike from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, both Edison and Nikola Tesla worked in Milwaukee. In fact, the Edison Electric Power thing in the Menominee Valley, that old building is still standing.
And great.
Out at Alice Chalmers, where Nikola Tesla worked, he invented the first turbine. And interesting, I've been listening to your arguments, and there's a book called The Prodigal Genius by O'Neill.
Wonderful book by the science editor of the New York Herald Tribune who knew Tesla.
Yeah.
Right. And that's actually a wonderful book.
Tesla improved the DC system in Edison's bolts. And then Edison reneged to pay him the $50,000, told him he was just kidding, you know. And that
well,
he didn't really
you know, if you
it.
Go back, I mean, you talk to someone like Paul Israel, you look at what $50,000, I mean, what that meant in the Edison company, it's extremely unlikely that anyone seriously expected to get $50,000 in payment for something like that. I mean, Tesla, there's no question that Tesla was badly treated in certain ways, but there's a lot of these sort of myths or, you know, stories or what have you, and I think it's, you shouldn't take them too totally seriously unless you can put them into context. And that $50,000 story, I think, if you look at how much money the Edison Corporate Company had in those days, I mean, it's just extremely unlikely that he would have been offering him those kinds of remuneration for what he was doing.
What were some of his more offbeat inventions, Jill?
You mean Edison?
Right.
Oh, it seemed to me that, he invented, like, an electric pencil. I'm not a good person to ask about that, because I was really totally focused on AC versus DC. Maybe you've got some callers who can, I mean, it sounds like you've got some, very, very good people on your lines. Maybe someone can call in and fill in on
yeah.
that. I mean, I really know more about his major inventions, but he had a ton of, smaller ones.
Mm-hmm. Only on public radio could you have debates about this kind of information.
Right,
I'm just flabbergasted.
Well, Tesla has a very devoted and fervent following because he is an interesting guy.
Yes, and you write about him in your piece. You call him one of the world's true eccentric geniuses.
Well, he had a lot of very particular things. Like, he liked everything to be divided by three. So if he booked himself into a room, it ought to be a room that could be divided by three.
Huh?
And he was very germophobic. He used to eat at Delmonico's pretty much every night. He was a very elegant man, very elegant, lived very well. Every piece of cutlery and, the dishes, the glassware, they would leave a big pile of napkins at his place. He was, a local, he was a usual, a regular every night. And he would use one napkin per piece of cutlery, per piece of crystal, and wipe all the germs off. The other thing I should say is that his great love in life was a white pigeon, of whom there is a photograph in his later years. He was a genius, but he was very
unusual. I didn't
realize
how eccentric he was. Bruce in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi. When I was growing up in the 40s, I learned about Edison and his friendship with Ford. I learned about him as a boy. And now my 8-year-old son has a second grade teacher who says Edison did not invent the light bulb by himself. He took ideas about the filament and ideas about the gas inside from other guys. What does your author know about that?
Well, he was not inventing on his own. That is completely correct. He had an invention factory, and if you read the various books about Edison, you'll find that he had all kinds of colleagues that he worked very closely with. Now, does that mean that he wasn't, the main person in this? No, he was the main person. But I should say that as time went on, the people who worked with Edison did come to resent how he really did not give adequate credit to others. And in fact, so my book came out in 2002, and I, went hither and yon doing book promotion. And I mean, I met a number of people who were the descendants of people who had worked with Edison. And in one case, one of them was a cameraman at a local television station who told me that his father, and this is, he had worked on the movies with Edison. And in that case, I think, it really is a case that Edison was not the main mover and shaker there. And he said his father left Edison's, by this time Edison had an even bigger lab in Orange, New Jersey, had moved. He said his grandfather, whatever it was, had great-grandfather, had left because Edison just wasn't giving him enough credit. And he went on then to, have a whole rather illustrious inventing career of his own. Edison was not a lone individual working by himself. He was working in Menlo Park with a big backup crew, and you can read about any of this. There are a lot of biographies of Edison, but, and for your son, there, I'm guessing there are probably several good biographies that are, you know, sort of aimed at that at age group.
Sure. Thanks for the call. One final for you, an email from John in Milwaukee. In a book called The Electric Universe, they tell a story about Alexander Graham Bell. In that story, Western Union hired one of their young telegraph operators to try to steal Bell's new invention, the telephone. They claimed that the young telegraph operator Western Union had hired to try and steal the invention was a young Thomas Edison. Could you tell us anything about this story and how true it might be?
I do not know. But what I can tell you is that one of the other ways that, Edison made his name in life was improving the telephone. But I don't know, you know, anything about that. And it was in working on the telephone that he, I mean, and they, again, write about this in the Time issue, that he came to sort of understand, oh, well, we could do these other things. And that was the beginning of the phonograph, the amplification of sound.
Hmm. Well, quite a guy he was. Thank you, Jill, so much for being with us. We're going to meet his great-grandson now, so thank you so much.
Yes, well, thanks for having me. As I say, it is always fun to talk about Thomas Edison.
I know, and a lot of people who are listening share that. That's true. Jill Jones, journalist and author, whose books include Empires of Light, Edison, Tesla, Westinghouse, and the Race to Electrify the World, and most recently, Eiffel's Tower and the World's Fair, where Buffalo Bill beguiled Paris, the artists quarreled, and Thomas Edison became a count. She is a journalist and has done all kinds of different reporting and has a particular fascination with the Gilded Age here in the U.S. We continue. We're talking about Thomas Edison this hour of the program. The Time Magazine 9th History issue is on Thomas Edison. It's the cover story. I'm trying to get to the cover here with a picture of Thomas Edison. How one powerful idea changed America, inside his idea factory, and why he is relevant today. David Sloan is a professor of English at the University of New Haven, and he is the great-grandson of Thomas Edison, and we're so delighted. We've had him on before, but we haven't had the Time Magazine issue, so we have him on a different light this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls for David, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Hi, David. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
It's nice to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. So what kinds of stories did you hear about your great-grandfather? Were people proud of him as you were growing up, or did they think he was an eccentric?
Well, my family, they didn't think he was eccentric because to them, in fact, he was quite normal. my grandmother, Madeline, otherwise we called her Toots, Thomas Edison's daughter, one of the things that used to make her maddest was they always talked about father as if he was a rough boor. There's even a book, I think, titled The Genius Who Spat on the Floor. And she said, we all cringed every time we heard that, because spitting on the floor in a lab where there are 95 muckers and they're all chewing tobacco is not like being in Glenmont, his iconic home that he was associated with later in his life, with the Persian carpets and the heads of state from the Far East coming to call. So they used to get quite frustrated about that.
Yeah. Jill was saying, our guest before who wrote one of the books about the Gilded Age, was saying that he must have been a hard guy to live with because he was such a workaholic. And Time indicates that he would get together with his inventing buddies and come up with an idea at midnight and then just work all night.
He was very much like that. And Mina, his wife, on many, many occasions, sent sandwiches and apple pie and milk. He was very fond of apple pie and milk to the point of crankiness, down to the lab because they were putting in an all-nighter. I've got a time card that my grandmother made copies of. I've got a copy of it. Shows him working 114 hours one week, according to the Edison factory time card. So, yeah, he put in a lot of work. When he wasn't working, he was working too. He was always reading, always gathering, always observing. His mind, I don't think, ever really shut down much.
Yeah. I mean, it must make you feel great that, you know, a part of your mind is his mind, doesn't it?
Well, I'm not sure which part.
Well, let me ask you that. Which part do you think?
I don't know. My brother has 14 patents, my older brother Tom. So he certainly got the inventive side. I find that if I look at things mechanically long enough, I can usually figure out why they're not working. But I can't do anything with electrical stuff. So I might have gotten a little bit of the mechanic from him, and I read a tremendous amount. In fact, I'm sitting in a room now with one wall is covered with 300 books of 19th century poetry.
Oh, my.
On which I'm going to write a couple of books.
Oh.
You know, and so that the hunter-gatherer, inquirer instinct sort of got channeled with me into literature, but I don't know otherwise what I might share of his.
Well, wasn't there, I think Time, or maybe I read this somewhere else, indicated that at some point in his life he thought about being an actor, but he had a bad voice?
Well, he had, he also had trouble hearing. He had a very Midwestern twang, not crazy Midwestern twang, but then the Midwestern, the Ohio accent is not, you know, pronounced in such a way that it's really, really noticeable. But he had a little bit of that broad, flat A sound in his talk, and his wife, Mina, too. So he would have been great in character parts. But, you know, with that giant forehead, he would have stood out, too. As any
yeah, they mentioned the giant forehead. I didn't even notice it until they mentioned it. It was a big forehead, huh? How big was it?
Big enough so that he only found, I think, one person in his lifetime who had a bigger hat size.
No.
Something like that.
Oh, yeah. My.
He was very proud of the fact that no one had hats on the shelves that could fit him.
Which indicated that he was very smart.
Well, that's the phrenological theory. And if you go with that, it sure is true.
Right.
He had a lot of room there to pack stuff in.
He was very smart, wasn't he? What a very, very smart guy.
Well, he was given up for being hopelessly stupid about the time that you and I would have been entering, I guess, first to second grade. And his mother, Nancy Edison, took him home and said, well, you know, I'm going to educate him. And she had been a school teacher, so it's not exactly just pure homeschooling. But she took over his education, and he became an omnivorous reader. He read everything he could get his hands on. I know he was doing chemistry lab experiments as early as when he was living in Port Huron, and that's from about 8 through 15. So somebody, or himself, was buying chemicals and knew what chemicals to buy. So, you know, he was highly educated, even though he put it out that he was not interested in hiring college men because college had blunted their intelligence. It's less known, perhaps, that in 1929 and 1930, he mounted national scholarship competitions.
Really?
To send the winner on to college with the purpose of encouraging American youth to think about engineering and the practical sciences as places to direct their educations.
So he
was much more, and part of that was Mina's influence, but that's Thomas Edison. He saw the nation is not producing enough engineers. He was very concerned. And the way to solve it is to raise the profile of engineering, make it very public, get behind it, and back it with his own money. And he did that for 2 years. They did not have a competition in 31, because at that point he was very ill and, you know, died.
The article, the Time article, indicates that, it's interesting what you just said, that our interest in science, other countries are way ahead of us, and our interest in science is not nearly as dominant as it was during the Gilded Years. Today, more than a right, it says here, more than 160 years after his birth, America is losing its scientific edge, and other countries are spending a lot more money on helping people with degrees in science or engineering. Do you think your great-grandfather would have had a huge, huge scholarship program now? And would you agree that we're not at the cutting edge anymore?
Well, I know that Edison would be frantic if he saw the way things were going in this country now.
Frantic.
In terms of science and engineering education. Oh, yeah, he'd be frantic. He'd see, first he predicted that fossil fuels would run out and strongly advocated developing sun power as an alternative.
Really?
Oh, yes. And, of course, no one listened. And then the gasoline engine and the car phenomenon took over our culture. There were some electric cars. As late as the 1940s, a guy named Tucker had a viable electric car. But they couldn't compete, so they got wiped out. But the fact of the matter is, he would be saying, okay, now you waited very long, and it's almost too late, but you better get your son act together and harness that stuff because it's free and it doesn't run out. And so he would be very heavily behind major, massive investments in that. He'd be tremendously alarmed also by the amount of chemicals that are going into the ocean and the turning more acidic of the ocean. He'd be tremendously alarmed by the greenhouse effect obliterating species.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot he would be very concerned with. Oh, he would be at the forefront of the ecological movement for sure. He would be inventing in that area, trying to harness plants to make them more useful. Advocating alternative sources of power. He was right on spot as early as 1900, through the 1920s. He was harvesting goldenrod to make rubber.
Was he really?
Oh, yeah. That was one of the big things he was doing at the end of his life.
Huh.
And he had it developed to the point where it was about viable. That's what Thomas Edison Chemist, a very good book on him by a chemical engineer, says. And then, of course, the Germans came up with synthetic rubber fabricated from, guess who, petroleum products.
Right.
Chemically.
Right. Right.
And since petroleum was cheaper, I mean, you know, back in those days when people thought of Arabia, they thought of a camel and T.E. Lawrence, you know, but nothing more. You know, it's only now that we realize that they're they're capitalists just like we are, and they're capable of intense competition, market manipulation, and they don't think the way we think about basic freedoms of democracy.
Right.
Oh, yeah, and Edison would be concerned on all those bases. He'd look at the Middle East politics, and he'd be very upset by that as well, because it is plain that a lot of the Middle Eastern religions are not like Christianity and the Judeo-Christian tradition, and they're not very tolerant of dissent. And I'm not, you know, I didn't come on, you know, I didn't accept the opportunity to talk here to get into a religious thing. But Thomas Edison was four square behind American values, freedom, self-expression, independence, and sun power does that, and cooling the environment so that species survive does that. The food chain doesn't break down because they harvest krill out of the southern pole area, and the base of the food chain collapses. All kinds of stuff we're starting to do now that he would look at and say, that's the wrong way to go.
Oh, and he would have moved us ahead, too, on all of those things that we've been saying. Maybe we need to develop solar power. Oh, yeah, he was in the right century, but we need him in this one, too. Let's go to phone calls for the great-grandson of Thomas Edison. Professor David Sloan is our guest, professor of English at the University of New Haven. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. You can also reach us on Facebook. We want to let you know that we have books that we talk about frequently, and once we get up to 1,000 Facebook people, and we're getting to the point where we're talking to each other and having some fun on that kind of outlet, which, and it's informative too. It's not just fun, it's educational. Once we get up to 1,000, we're going to be doing a random drawing for a couple of books, of books that we've talked about on the air. So that's kind of cool. You can find us at The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. Two calls for Professor David Sloan, great-grandson of Thomas Edison, in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, starting with Betty in Oak Creek. Hi, Betty.
Oh, thank you so much. What a wonderful guest you have on. It's an interesting topic. One of my favorite people that growing up, I'm 74, and Thomas Edison was an inspiration. And one of my questions was regarding his schooling, and I often think that was such an inspiration for me because I was not what you call a good student or even a smart person, but reading his all those books out, how they thought he was so too stupid to go to school, and here this was a genius.
Right.
And I think, where is he? Why don't we have another Thomas Edison here?
I'm with you, Betty. Where is he now, David?
Well, some people say he's no further away than Bill Gates.
So. Ah.
The advances in computer technology are breathtaking. I think the Edison Industries, I'm not sure whether Edison's mind would have gone that way or not, but it would have been a good place for his invention factories to go into. 20 years ago, I would walk into a classroom and not a single student would have any way of communicating with the outside. No iPods, no cell phones, nothing. Now, 20 years later, so, you know, we're talking 1990 to 2010, every single student in the class has a cell phone,
right.
Usually with no exceptions. And at least half of them have iPods, and a couple of them think that they can listen to my lecture with the earbud still stuck in their ear.
What are they thinking?
That's not possible.
I say banish them from the room.
Yeah, but you know, as far as the smart thing goes, I'm not sure this is an Edison trait of mine. But you asked earlier, and this very good statement here makes me want to respond. My brother and I were both diagnosed as being mildly retarded.
Were you really?
About first and second grade, we had a terrible time learning how to read.
Huh.
And the kindly school teachers called us in and explained that perhaps, you know, we needed to be in some special educational setting because we just weren't up to what the other kids were up to. And my parents were, of course, totally outraged, as was Nancy Edison. And they simply started reading to us every night at bedtime. Mom would take one of us and Dad would take the other. There were just two. And they read to us for a long time, and ultimately, in about 7 or 8 years, we became avid readers.
Hmm.
And, you know, then the outcome is that I've written 8 books, and my brother's,
right.
You know, got 14 patents. That just wasn't so obvious when we were 7 and 8 years old.
My, you're a professor of English, for heaven's sake.
That's right.
Oh, my.
So, you know, this is lots of people get off to unpromising starts, and diagnosing too overly quickly is maybe a mistake.
Yes. Betty, thanks for the call. Pete in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, David.
Hi.
I visited the Edison family home and the factory as well at West Orange several times over the years. And people should know it's a very lovely home. But they didn't design it or build it. They just bought it. And over the years, they really didn't do much to it. And what I wanted to briefly mention was in the home is a picture taken at a Christmas gathering, and I don't know what year it was, but it really exemplifies how they just weren't into material things. Even though they had this lovely home, in the picture taken at Christmas time, everybody's seated on folding chairs. I don't get the impression that the Edison family was cheap, but they sure were thrifty, and I'm just wondering if you can shed some insights on where that extreme thriftiness might have come from.
Hmm.
Boy, that's an interesting question. Of course, you have to bring in folding chairs if you're bringing in more people than you had chairs regularly. Anyway, I guess. But the Edison Winter Home in Florida, if you look at in the way the rooms are furnished, it's a summer cottage. It's not a broken down, beat up summer cottage, but it was itself prefabricated, assembled on the spot. You know, we're not talking about a grand mansion. It is nothing like. It is like a summer cottage. And it's furnished like a summer cottage. You know, with just the standard chairs of the period, the standard tables, the standard dressers. There is nothing whatsoever that is in any way Vanderbiltian or J.P. Morgan-esque or any of those things. And, you know, that's one they did do from scratch themselves. So I'm inclined to say, Pete, that your observation is very correct. It wasn't about material things. For Edison, it was about inventing and creating, which he saw as his patriotic duty and his duty to man. And, you know, was very strong about that. He had no objection to making money doing it, and neither did anybody else in those days. In fact, making money was considered also to be very patriotic. You know, and that was true from Eli Whitney's time on. Why did Eli Whitney invent interchangeable parts and make guns? Well, there were two reasons. One, people stole his cotton gin because it was too simple. And two, the government would pay him to make guns because we needed guns because nobody wanted a democracy to succeed. And we had a lot of enemies in the world. So, you know, and Edison's the same way. He says, you know, we've got a great democratic experiment going. We have a wonderful country here. It's going to need to be defended.
Pete, thanks for your call. Let's go to Steve in Rhinelander. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have several pictures of Thomas Edison and President Harding, you know, sitting around talking. And then later on, after President Harding died, Coolidge seemed to be such a kind of a promoter and cheerleader for inventors and seemed to be so proud of the American technology. And I see that partnership, and I'm wondering if we need that today more with the government and the scientists, and if perhaps our media is glorifying the wrong people. And I was wondering what your guest thought of that.
You always have good callers in. This is the second time I've heard very, very shrewd
they are good, aren't
questions
they?
Yeah, that come from unexpected angles. That's a fabulous question. One, Thomas Edison tried to get involved in the government around the time of World War I. They invited him, the government invited him, to put his mind to work for the U.S. Navy. And he did work on submarines and batteries for submarines and things like that. But he found working with the government himself very frustrating because government is different from a corporation owned by the chief inventor. And that corporation can change directions, can move fast. When something doesn't work, Thomas Edison said, okay, now I know another thing that doesn't work. I can cross that off my list. Governments, you know, they like to not to take such a large profile, and a lot of individuals in government don't feel like taking risks. So the government is, to a certain extent, with grants for the National Science Foundation and the National Endowment for the Humanities. But Edison also made phonographs, and he also invented the talking picture.
Yes, the talking picture.
Yeah,
we tend to forget that.
That was not a wartime effort. That was to make money and to make inventions that people enjoyed and made their lives better.
Right.
So, he was in favor of popular culture, too. He was not opposed to it, but he would be alarmed.
Let's go to one final. We're almost out of time, darn. A little Myra listener. I think one of the reasons that our country puts out so few scientists has to do with science being one of the most difficult courses of study. A person really has to have a passion for science in order to take the difficult science courses that are offered in college.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's not an easy field. It's not an entry field that someone can just say, okay, now I'll be a scientist. It takes a lot of preparation. And then to develop good and new ideas, it also takes a lot of knowledge of the literature. So, you know, you couldn't just sit down with some technology, some wheels and springs, in the same way, not consistently. I'm sure there are people out there, however, who do sit down still with engineering tasks like that and invent genuinely new things. I've noticed our patent office has not shut down.
That's true. Have you invented something? I know you said your brother had. Have you?
No, I'm afraid not.
Not yet.
Not yet. Hmm. Not yet. I have an 11-year-old, and she's determined to invent things.
Ah.
She has, but I can't tell you what she's invented because, of course, she hasn't got a patent yet.
Oh, well, when she gets one, let us know. You're so delightful. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, I enjoyed it, Kathleen, and I enjoyed talking to your wonderful listeners. It was just a treat to be with you all in Wisconsin.
Well, it's a treat to have you with us, that's for sure. And it's true about the listeners. Only here could you have people who have intimate knowledge, not only of Edison, but the time in Milwaukee and Tesla and the arguments and who had what first. And you love it. You just love it. Thanks to David Sloan, professor of English at the University of New Haven and great-grandson of Thomas A. Edison. Jill Jones with us earlier, a journalist whose books include Empires of Light, Edison, Tesla, Westinghouse, and the Race to Electrify the World. Tomorrow during this time period, it's close to the 4th of July, a wonderful book, Declaration, the Nine Tumultuous Weeks When America Became Independent. Just 9 weeks, May 1st through, well, it was building before that, but incredible what happened then, May 1st to July 4th of 1776. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks for all of your erudite calls.